minutes ago. Looking real good in my passport photo.
The Amateur Traveler, episode 689. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about sand dunes and deserts and hot air ballooning, zebras, giraffes, oryxes, as we go to Namibia to Sususvlei and Namib Naukluft National Park. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. Let's talk about Namibia. I'd like to welcome the show Karthik Iyer, who is currently from Boston, but has come to talk to us about Namibia. Karthik, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Chris. Good to be here.
Now, you pitched me a region of Namibia we haven't talked about in the two episodes that we have done on this South African country. Where are we going to talk about today?
The region of Namibia that I am keen to talk about today is a place called Sususvlei. Sususvlei is essentially a set of marshes that's located in the southern part of the Namib Desert. And it's basically a large salt and clay pan. So it's near where the Namib Desert abuts into the Kalahari. And it's one of the many vleis, which actually means marsh and not valley, along with Dead Vlei and Hidden Vlei in the Namib Desert.
Excellent. And why should someone go to Namibia?
That's a great question. Namibia is one of the largest countries in the world, which you might not realize if you just look at the map. Specifically, when you really think about it, it brings to mind, if you've ever seen the pictures of large, massive orange dunes that are standing up against the sky, infinite sea of sand dunes that are stretching out onto infinity with beautiful night sky and what have you, that's exactly what Sususvlei is. Interestingly enough, the area of this whole Sususvlei salt pan is 32,000 square kilometers. So that's a giant sand sea. And to say that it's isolated does not even begin to cover it.
Excellent. I'm going to enjoy this episode. Just for background for people, my son used to edit this show. When we did the very first show on Namibia, he was the editor. He was the editor while he was in college and then a little bit afterwards. And at the time, he had said he was going to stop traveling with us. He had seen enough cathedrals in Europe and wasn't interested in going places. And when we did the first episode on Namibia, he edited it and sent it along with a note that said, well, that Namibia sounds interesting. And it was like, who are you and what have you done with my son? And we've had that kind of reaction to this country on the show where we've had people who've gone for their honeymoons or who have gone and loved it. It is well up on my list. So I'm excited about this. Where are we going to start?
Before we get into all the sand dunes and the other fun stuff, I do think that it's helpful to start with the city of Windhoek.
The capital.
Exactly. That actually includes a church, which your son may not find interesting. When you fly into Namibia, the first city that you fly into is Windhoek. It is a very small city, but it is also very, very cosmopolitan. I mean, you have very high-end gyms, lots of great restaurants and what have you, and it feels very different from the rest of the country. There are a couple of interesting places that I think everyone should visit. The first one is the Independence Memorial Museum, which was actually built by North Korea.
Ha. Huh.
Exactly. I know. That was exactly my reaction. The interesting thing about this museum is that it showcases the history of the Namibian resistance to colonialism.
In this case, that'd be colonialism from South Africa, predominantly, or you're talking about the German colonialism?
This is colonialism from Germany.
Okay.
One of the things that's not very well known is that in the early 1900s, about 100,000 Namibians were killed, with about 20,000 German troops involved, where General Lothar von Trotha issued orders to basically kill every male and drive all the women and children into the desert. Now, what's interesting is that historically, this is considered the first genocide of the 20th century. And in many ways, apparently, the Nazis were sort of inspired by the approach that the general took in how Namibia was subjected to this sort of genetic cleansing, if you will. So this is not something that I had ever heard of or known. And it was really terrifying to read and hear about how this said, the prelude to, you know, subsequent German actions around the world. So in many ways, going to this museum and hearing about the suffering of the Herero and the Nama people brought to light a history that I think is very much hidden when it comes to the Western world.
It's interesting. I know more about the trouble that Namibia had with South Africa because I saw some of that when I was, for instance, down in Cape Town, and you go to the museum, the island prison where Nelson Mandela was and all of the other leaders. They also talk there about the South African imperialism, I want to use the term, I don't know if that's the correct term in this case, but it's your neighbor, had over the later period after the Germans pulled out. So they had some tough times.
They had some tough times, and they certainly do talk about that as well. But a lot of it is focused on essentially the genocide of the people, much more so than the subsequent independence from South Africa. The other place that you should definitely check out in Windhoek is a church that's called the Christ Church, which was built by the famous German architect Gottlieb Redeker. The interesting thing about this church is this was designed at the period when the genocide happened, but with the idea of peace. So it was originally called the Church of Peace, and the whole idea behind it was to bring together the various communities that were warring. Interestingly enough, the general on the Namib side, Samuel Marrero, was actually trained as a priest, and the whole idea was that we all come together and stop fighting and unite over, you know, this common idea of a church. But of course, that didn't really happen for a whole lot of reasons. Nevertheless, the church has a very beautiful and very unique architecture. And over the years, the fact that the church tried to unite people and tried to bring people together, it's affectionately earned the term marriage church because it's where people came to get married for good luck. So now, on any given day, you'll find people, whether they're Germans or South Africans or Nama or Herero, come to the church to get married from all over the country and all over sub-Saharan Africa.
And I imagine that someone might be able to tell what group they're from by the traditional dresses?
I believe so, yes.
Okay. Not a lot of experience there. Okay.
Not a lot of experience there, no, unfortunately. I've only been married to my wife very recently, so.
That's okay. You don't need to marry multiple people to get more experience on my behalf, so. Excellent. Where else? Anything else we want to do in Windhoek before we head out into the desert?
Other than that, there is obviously the Tintin Palace, which is the Namibian parliament. Apparently, this is also very interesting to go in and visit because the way the parliament is designed, it has taken a lot of influence from, you know, the more traditional Namibian cultures and tribes and so on. Unfortunately, the day that we went, it was closed, so we could not get a tour to see inside. But obviously, that's something that's also being touted as a place to visit when you're there.
Okay.
The one thing I would say is that when you're in Windhoek, it is incredibly important to stock up on a lot of food, a lot of water, and of course, beer. You're not going to run into any 7-Elevens or gas stations on the way.
Okay.
And so stock up on as much as you can. And secondly, you're not going to have any cell phone reception in the middle of the Namib Desert. So physical paper maps, as well as anything that you can download on your phone to make sure that you have all the maps and everything in place, makes a huge difference when you go on this long drive.
Now, you say on this long drive, so we are talking about a self-drive trip, we should say.
So you have two options from Windhoek. Mm-hmm. You do have little planes that will take you to Sossusvlei. They're not operated very reliably, but they do exist. Or you can basically drive down there. Everyone that we talked to suggested that the planes are a risky proposition and that we should probably drive down. So we decided to go ahead and drive down. And typically, the drive itself is only 5 hours, technically. But the reality is that the roads are not the greatest. And given the conditions, and if you stop on the way and what have you, it'll probably take you 8 hours. That's the reality of, you know, where you'll be driving through.
Okay.
Now, the good news is that when you start heading down there, I mean, I would suggest getting started as early as possible. So we started heading out at 6 o'clock in the morning, and it was perfect because we left the city as the sun was rising and we had some wonderful views of the landscape, which is really barren and empty, but it's very surreal in a way. And you'll see a lot of antelopes, a lot of giraffes, mountain zebras, Some others have seen cheetahs as well. We did not see any. But you'll just see wildlife as you get closer and closer into the wild country.
Well, and there's one question I forgot to ask about the stocking up part. Is there a particular beer we're supposed to pick up? I asked this for my beer drinking friends. I'm not a beer lover, so it didn't occur to me until later here.
I do not remember off the top of my head, but all I'll say is that there was not a whole lot of variety there. So.
Got it.
From Windhoek, as you start driving, there is a beautiful place called the Nuklift Mountain Zebra Park. Depending on the time of the year, you can see massive herds of mountain zebras. Unfortunately, we were there at a time when we couldn't see them. But it was this amazing oasis of greenery, which is in the middle of this barren Martian landscape, for lack of a better term.
Hmm.
The only place in the world that comes closest to this is the Australian outback. That's what Namibia reminded me of, this massive desert and open area. And watching this oasis of greenery with all these beautiful, strange-looking flowers and flora and fauna was just incredible.
Well, and you say open landscape. I'm picturing, for instance, being in the Sahara, and deserts don't always look like what we think. For instance, even the Sahara isn't all sand dunes. What is this that I'm seeing? Is it sand? Is it scrub? Is it barren rock?
It's not like the Sahara. It's much more like a combination of Death Valley with sand dunes.
Okay.
So that's the way that I would describe this as.
Okay.
The interesting thing is, in the middle of all this complete barren landscape, on the way to the zebra park, we ran into a family of San, one of the local tribe. They're essentially what used to be called the Bushmen. We saw this family that was on the move, and it was a fairly, you know, probably like 6 or 7 of them, and we saw them walking around the wilderness. We stopped the car, turned around, and we went looking for them, and we couldn't find them. It was just amazing that in the span of 10 minutes, an entire family of 6 or 7 adults just disappeared into this open, barren landscape. It sort of brings to mind just how skilled they are at evading people if they need to. And it was a very, very surreal experience.
Excellent.
The other thing we would really suggest is when you are driving into the Sossusvlei and the Namib Desert, please get a 4x4. I mean, you do ask sure. in your show notes. I've heard your shows many times where you ask, hey, what's the one thing that Lonely Planet gets wrong or the guidebooks get wrong? They say, oh, you can drive a 2x2. Please don't drive a 2x2. We basically had a flat tire just by driving a 4x4, and we had to fix it. And it's interesting because you drive through these roads where you're like, oh, wow, the roads are so crappy. And then there was one stretch where we were like, oh, wow, look, the roads are nice. There's even railings on the side. And then we realized it was basically a steep downhill drive at an incredible decline. And imagine sand and gravel and wind blowing on the road. So you're hydroplaning on sand down this decline. And you realize that is why they actually have railings and nicer roads here. So there is no way that you can have a 2x2 and do this well. In fact, on our ride back, we saw at least 2 vehicles that were stranded because they didn't have gas or they didn't have spare tires or the right vehicle. So highly recommended that you either go with a shuttle service or somebody who will take you there, mm-hmm. or you get a really nice vehicle that can handle the conditions.
Okay. Good to know.
From essentially the zebra park, you head out to a town that's called Solitaire. And Solitaire looks really out of Disney's Mater's Tall Tales. It literally has this little card that's broken down, and it literally has a picture, and it's beautiful. But bear in mind, from the time in Windhoek until Solitaire, there are no gas stations. So this is the only place where you can get gas or beer or food or anything else at all. So that's one thing to keep in mind. The other thing to keep in mind, which people don't tell you, is that Namibia, being a former German colony, is that they're very, very punctual, which means that if they say the gas station is going to close at 6 o'clock, the gas station will be closed at 6 o'clock. So you are out of luck. So plan your trips accordingly, because whether it's a national park or whether it's a gas station or whether it's anything else, ours are very, very, very strict.
I think of that versus the more flexibility in the hours in some of the rest of Africa, where if it says it closes at 6, may it close at 5. So,
in many ways, it works against you because mm-hmm. a lot of people who are used to traveling in other parts of Africa come to Namibia and then they sign up for a tour. They assume the 5 o'clock tour will take off at 6 o'clock. Uh-huh. They show up at 5:30 and the tour has left. So, so then once you get to Solitaire, there is a place called Sesriem, which is where there's a canyon, and that is the entrance to the Nakluft National Park. There's an actual paved road here, but getting to the sand dunes and to the park requires that you know how to drive in the sand. So we stayed at a lodge right next to the Sesriem Canyon called the Sosusle Lodge.
Okay.
So the Sosusle Lodge basically is probably a kilometer from the canyon, so which meant that we could wake up in the morning, go to the canyon, get our permits, and then drive straight into the actual Sosusle National Park itself.
So there's a daily permit that is required?
There is a daily permit that is required. It is 80 Namibian dollars per person and 10 per car. Being one US dollar is about 14 Namibian dollars.
Okay. Well, wow, that's not bad at all. Okay.
So this is where you get into the fun part. When you get into the actual Sosusle itself, you will see these massive, incredible dunes of various sizes and shapes. The interesting thing is that these dunes are well over 1,000 feet tall, and they come in various shapes and sizes. For example, you have a type of dune that's called a star dune, which is not found anywhere else. Because of the fact that the winds are coming in from every direction, the dune takes the form of a starfish, which is very fascinating. And then you have other types of dunes that are basically your typical dunes that look exactly like what you'd imagine them to look like. And you have dunes named after famous landmarks. For example, there is Dune 45. It's about 560 feet tall, but it's very stunning visually. It's by the 45th mile marker. That's why it's called Dune 45. And then there's Dune 7, which is different from the Dune 7 in the Walvis Bay near Swakopmund, which where one of your earlier interviewers basically talked about having climbed that dune. The interesting thing is that the sand here is over 5 million years old. So this sand is so old that it comes from a mix of the Kalahari Desert and from the sand pan that's been there. And it's got this iridescent orange that changes with the time of the day. And I have not seen anything like it anywhere else in the world.
It looks quite photogenic from the pictures I'm seeing.
Yeah, it is incredible. So then we spent the day basically climbing a whole bunch of dunes, which was a lot of fun because in many ways, every new type of dune that you climb, it gives you a feeling for the landscape and just how varied it can get. Mm-hmm. But then what we decided was to basically camp out on the night of that particular day, because rather than drive all the way back to the lodge, you can have campsites, which are actually pretty sophisticated. So you have indoor plumbing, you have electricity outlets, and you can set up your camp next to it. So you have access to a lot of the modern amenities while you are getting set up for the night and for the next day.
Did you need to decide that ahead of time as you get the permit in the morning that you're going to camp out?
In fact, you should decide that way ahead of time because during the peak season, it gets to be pretty busy. So the campsites and the lodges tend to get full pretty easily. So you should definitely plan all of that at least a couple of months in advance.
And you say the peak season. We didn't talk about what time of year you went.
The peak season is actually around winter in the northern hemisphere. So it's anywhere from around October, November through March.
Okay. And so you're in summer there. What are the temperatures?
We're there in spring, essentially. So the temperatures didn't get too warm.
So you're there around November or something like that?
It was around November. Exactly. The temperatures didn't get too crazy during the evenings, but during the day, it certainly hits about 90 to 95 degrees.
Okay. And then much cooler in the evening, I would expect.
Incredibly cooler in the evenings. And also, as the Danes would say, there is no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothing. So please come prepared with adequate layers. Just because it's a desert does not mean that it's going to be pleasant in the evenings.
Right. No, it means quite the opposite. You'll have a larger change of temperature in a desert climate. Yeah.
When we were there, we decided to climb one of the biggest dunes called Big Daddy, which is 325 meters or 1,066 feet. And on the way there, one of my friends had decided to swap out one of the bags with a bag with his tripod. And the other bag had several liters of water that he left behind in the car. So halfway through that climb to one of the tallest dunes in the world, in the middle of the afternoon, we realized that we were out of water, or we basically had half a liter of water to share between three of us. And of course, we climb all the way to the top, we make it there. And rather than take the hard way of basically hiking back down, we decided, well, we don't have a lot of time and we're really thirsty, so let's just try to
slide down.
Slide down on our bottoms, down this really steep side of the dunes. And of course, we start doing that, except that it had rained for the first time in 6 or 7 years in there. And the desert pan itself had a little bit of water. And so we slide down and we land flat into this slushy, uncomfortable, sandy, marshy thing, for lack of a better term. And then we hike back to our car. And of course, we had cold beer and water and oranges. And there were these older German tourists who had been there, who were waiting to go on. They have these shuttles that'll take you to see the dunes, not necessarily climb them.
Okay.
They see us hang out there trying to bite off these oranges and chug beer. We just look like hell, covered in all kinds of grime, and they probably were thinking, what the hell are these guys up to? So from there, what we did the next day was we drove to what's called Dead Valley, or Death Marsh. To me, this is the most beautiful place that I've ever seen in the world. This is a gorgeous clay pan with dead trees that haven't rotten away because there is no humidity.
Mm-hmm.
These trees are hundreds of years old, and they are skeletons of camel thorn trees. And they're sitting here in the middle of the cracked desert pan. And walking around and exploring these trees and looking at this is just amazing. And it gets really hot very quickly. So what I'd suggest is getting started on this as soon as possible and taking in the views while you still can. In the afternoons, it gets prohibitively odd because you don't have any shades of the dunes because it's very open, which means that you're getting inundated by both the sun as well as the reflection from the clay pan onto you. So it can get very unpleasant very quickly.
Well, and we talked about wearing layers, and clearly you're bringing sunscreen. Are there other recommendations you would have for clothing? A hat, I'm assuming.
The one thing I learned the hard way is that your neck will burn incredibly easily, especially your neck and the back of your head. A hat doesn't quite cover it. So having some sort of a towel, or what the Arabs would wear, right? Something that basically covers up that part, is very, very helpful. Second thing is everybody tends to ignore their legs. I made the same mistake. I wore shorts. I had my upper body very thoroughly covered, and my legs were burned in ways that I had never imagined they could burn. And I'm talking knees and ankles and calves. Your legs are right next to the salt pan, and you have all that sun that's reflecting off of it. Trust me, having burned legs makes it really hard to put socks on for a long, long time.
Yep. One thing we didn't talk about is the name of the national park and what it means. I don't know if this is something that you caught in your travels.
I mean, the name of the national park is Nakluf National Park. It is essentially considered the largest game park in Africa. It's part of the Nakluft mountain range, and obviously you have the Namib Desert as well, but I'm not entirely sure of the etymology.
Namib means open space, and therefore Namibia, the land of open spaces.
Interesting.
Which I just learned moments ago, so I thought it would be interesting to people because I think that's very descriptive.
Interestingly enough, the Lonely Planet says that the Nama word Namib actually means vast dry plain, which I assume is similar as open space. So from there, we actually went down to another marsh that's called Hidden Lay. The interesting thing, and I don't think I talked about this before, is that you have all these lakes that are marshes that make up Sossusvlei and the region. Sossusvlei is one of the marshes. Hidden Lay is a hidden marsh. Death Lay is Death Marsh, and so on.
You're talking about there is V-L-E-I, Vlei.
That's correct.
Okay.
Interestingly enough, even among South Africans who are of Dutch origin, there is misconception that Vlei refers to valley, but apparently it refers to marsh, which we learned when we were there. The other place that you could go to from there is another marsh that's called Hidden Lay, which is very fascinating because while both Sossusvlei and Death Lay are very popular tourist destinations, Hidden Lay is sort of hidden. It's a little off the main path route that you would take, and it's not so clear where it's located. So in many ways, this means it's this less popular but incredibly pristine area that you could go to. It has other big dunes. One is called Big Mama, because Big Daddy was the other one, which is a hard one, but Big Mama is also pretty hard. And several other dunes. They're all various sizes and shapes and come with varying degrees of difficulties that you can climb and check out. Once that's done, we basically headed back to go back to our lodge because we had camped for a little while and we decided just head straight back to the lodge. The following morning, what we did was we signed up for a hot air balloon ride. We had heard that this is one of the must-do activities. This is an example of Namibian punctuality. We got picked up at 4:30 a.m. and there were a couple of Americans who assumed when they said 4:30 a.m., nothing would happen until 5 o'clock. At 4:30 a.m., the bus left without four Americans. So who were not happy when we got back? It was very fascinating. The interesting thing is you get on this hot air balloon, and the idea is that you would be in the air before sunrise. So from 4:30, you're driven for about an hour. You get to this place where they board you onto the balloon and you see the sunrise from up in the air. And because of the fact that you have a lot of fog and moisture in the air, the moisture slowly dissipates, clearing the vast desert in front of you. And it brings to mind the vastness in a way that you cannot see it anywhere else. It's really, really surreal.
And did you book that well in advance also?
We booked that about 2 weeks in advance.
Okay. And is there one provider or multiple providers? Or
there is basically one provider. So there is one provider that does a helicopter tour and one that does a hot air balloon tour.
Okay. And I'll put a link to that provider in the show notes.
One of the things that you will notice if you're lucky is you will see these lone oryxes. Oryxes are these giant antelopes of sorts with really big horns, and they tend to be pretty large. And interestingly enough, male bull oryxes tend to be very territorial, and they tend to mark a territory with whatever little greenery that's there, and they patrol this entire area looking for anybody who dares to encroach on it. And obviously, female oryxes that are looking for a partner or looking to eat come to the territory, and that's how the male mates. So as you can see from the pictures, we saw some male oryxes that were basically patrolling this area nonstop, and it's so vast, so empty, but not, you know, early in the morning, this oryx had been there making tracks back and forth. It was very surreal and unbelievable experience.
Well, and if people can't picture an oryx, it's the one with the long straight horns. They're what, foot and a half long or something like that? Half a meter? Actually, they're almost 3 feet long. I was underestimating. Okay, wow.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize they were that long. I mean,
well, you probably didn't get right up next to it, I would assume, having some common sense.
We were actually warned not to get closer to oryxes because they are extremely aggressive, and because it's only the male oryxes that tend to roam closer to the roads and what have you, they tend to get very, very aggressive and attack people.
Yeah, one would think territorial sort of goes with that.
Yeah, interestingly enough, they have a variety of oryx called the scimitar oryx, which is also with a lot more curved horns, if you will. One of the other interesting things that we noticed is we saw this flowering plant that's called Welwitschia. It's a large plant that's considered a living fossil, and that's only found in the Namib Desert. This is interesting because Welwitschia is one of these large, massive flowering plants whose pictures you've probably seen. They look like this prehistoric bunch of greens and flowers that hang out in the middle of the desert. It's fascinating seeing the size of it because it's mind-boggling to think that something that's larger than three people put together is a single plant. And they're large enough that you can see them from the actual hot air balloon ride. So when you go through the hot air balloon, you see these little spots of green and they tell you, oh, yeah, that's where the plant is.
The first European who recorded seeing this plant, I just thought this was interesting, was a Austrian botanist, Friedrich Welschwisch. He was quoted as saying they could do nothing but kneel down and gaze at it, half in fear, lest a touch should prove it a figment of the imagination. So they had a similar reaction that you did.
It's mind-boggling to imagine that in the middle of the massive, vast desert and salt pan with this incredibly alien-looking landscape, you have this massive plant that still manages to sustain life and manages to thrive even. And the contrast is striking in a way that you cannot put in words, because you see all this orange, all this vastness, and then you see this little bit of green and reddish, pinkish color, and the starkness stands out, and it seems so surreal to see this in the middle of it all.
Interesting. And it is named after our good friend, the Austrian doctor.
I did not know that. So then the hot air balloon landed at a really nice site, not on top of the sand dunes, but on top of a plateau of sorts that overlooked the sand dunes and the desert. And of course, in a few minutes, they had set up a full spread of some incredible food. Zebra carpaccio, kudu braai, braai is South African barbecue, pancakes, and so on. Our pilots performed the sabrage and served us some amazing champagne in the middle of the desert in this incredible, remote, desolate, yet pristine setting. And it was such a surreal experience. I mean, just sitting there with the wind blowing on our faces, trying not to get sand in our carpaccio, trying to drink our champagne as quickly as possible before it all flew away. Incredible, incredible experience. And from there, we basically were driven back to our lodge. On the way back to our lodge, we stopped by a canyon that's called the Sesarium Canyon. Interestingly enough, this is exactly near where the entrance to the park is as well. The history of the canyon is pretty interesting. There's a river that's called the Shawkup River, and this is one of the rivers that actually flows in through the Namib Desert. The source is in the Nokluft Mountains, and then it flows west and goes into Sossusvlei and ends there. Depending on the time of the year, right? I mean, the river goes in a little more or a little less.
Sure.
But the canyon that's actually been carved here is one of the oldest canyons in the world. You know, it's about 4 kilometers from Sesarium. And interestingly enough, the name Sesarium in Afrikaans means 6 rawhide thongs. So it's basically...
Okay.
It's how many thongs do you need to attach to get to the water that's underneath the canyon.
Okay. A practical knowledge.
So you can visit this beautiful canyon that's out there and go hike at the bottom of it and check it out. It's really fascinating. And unlike, let's say, Grand Canyon and such, which has a majestic feel, this has a very much historic feel. There's no other way to put it. In a way that it feels ancient, you can look at it and say, oh, wow, this used to be so much more grand, but it's been eroded and here it is, but this is what's left of what used to be so much grander. So that's sort of the sense you get.
Well, and just for scale, we're talking about something that's more of a slot canyon or a wadi, depending on what part of the world you're from here, right? So we're 100 feet deep, not Grand Canyon scale.
No. The canyon itself is supposed to be 16 million years old. The gorge is about 100 feet, and I believe the gorge itself was carved about 3 million years ago. that was the end of our trip. Seen these amazing dunes, climbed on top of a few, had a little adventure, checked out the Death Valley with all the trees, and then the Hidden Valley, and of course, the wonderful hot air balloon ride, seeing the oryxes and ostriches, and the Welwitschia, and of course, the Sisarim Canyon itself.
Is there anything you would do differently next time for this part that you've talked about already?
The interesting thing is that I have been to Namibia several times. So I have been to Etosha, I have been to the various parts of Namibia during various other trips. The one part I could not go to was the Skeleton Coast. And you could see the Skeleton Coast from the hot air balloon of sorts. You could see it in the distance.
Further north.
But it is further west, actually.
Oh, okay.
So Sisley is almost near the Skeleton Coast, except that you have a couple of hundred kilometers of sand dunes in between.
Got it.
But if you go a little further to the west, that's where it is. At the end of the day, it's like any other, you know, massive national park. It depends on how much time you have. If I had more time at my disposal, I would definitely like to have gone back to the Skeleton Coast and spent a little bit of time there and seeing how that is. And that's probably the biggest I wish I had moment for me.
Okay, excellent. And one of our other two shows on Namibia does talk about the Skeleton Coast for those of you listening who want to hear more. Excellent. Were you going to talk about the trip back here? Okay.
On the way back, we basically decided to drive to Windhoek from the Sossusvlei Lodge. But this time around, we decided to take a slightly longer route. The interesting thing is if you're willing to take a little bit of a detour for an hour or so, you can actually stop by the Tropic of Capricorn sign that's there. It's a little north of Sossusvlei Lodge from where we were leaving. It was, hey, we're here. We're probably not going to be back here again, so why not stop by and take a look at what it's all about?
It's interesting that you're in, I forget sometimes how further north Africa is, that you're in what we would call Southern Africa, which is usually Namibia, Botswana, and South Africa at least, and you're in the tropics, or you just crossed over into the tropics. Doesn't seem right to me, but...
thing that makes it really weird is not the fact that you're in the tropics, it's also the fact that the sign is hard to find. Basically, you're looking around for it and suddenly you see the sign in the middle of the desert that's just surrounded by a whole bunch of what you'd imagine Sahara looks like, right? I mean, rocks and a little bit of shrub and what have you, and there's just a sign. That's it and nothing else. And the sign has been vandalized by people writing all sorts of stuff on it. It's something you could just drive and easily miss. That's what makes it all the more surreal, because in all this vastness, you're there and you're like, oh, I'm in the tropics? That seems wrong.
You're right. It doesn't look tropical from our usual definition. I've got you there.
And interestingly enough, when we were there, there was a group of Germans who decided that they were going to take off their shirts and basically act like it's the tropics. So there were a group of Germans who were basically in their tropical gear, pretending that they're in the tropics, taking a photo there, which we found was interesting.
Funny. Anything else you want to cover before we get to some of our wrap-up questions?
A couple of things. I mean, one is, as I said before, please be prepared when it comes to your food and when it comes to the gas and drinks and so on. It is easy to underestimate just how massive and how vast this is, but this is truly the middle of nowhere and you will not get gas or food very easily. So be prepared for the worst. That's one thing. Second thing is Namibia does not have great food. This might come as a surprise given where you are. And given the fact that it's a German colony, but basically the food you will get is game meat that's seasoned with salt and pepper if you're lucky.
Okay.
There's not going to be a whole lot of anything else. So if you are a picky eater, you're out of luck. And if you're a vegetarian, you're definitely out of luck.
And when you say the food, you were doing camping, so you were cooking or preparing your own food. So this is in... when you're stopping in some place like Solitaire, there's a restaurant, or when you're in Windhoek?
Even in Sossusvlei Lodge.
Got it. Okay.
We decided to stop and camp, but a lot of people stay at the Sossusvlei Lodge and take day trips to see the dunes and come back, rather than try and hike them and climb them and so on. So the advantage you have of actually camping on the sites gives you the freedom to hike and have your own four-wheel drive to go as you please. But if you're going to see the things, there's no reason you cannot stay at a lodge and have good food. I mean, what passes for good food and a good bed every day.
Okay. A little more plain than you might get some places. Okay, good to know.
And sorry, one other thing that I forgot. One of my friends, he screamed in the middle of the night when we were staying at a lodge, and we came in to see what was going on, and there was this massive moth in his room. When we say massive, the moth probably had a wingspan of a foot and a half. That was in his room, and he freaked out. And of course, the lady came in, thought that he was being a little kid, and grabbed the moth and tossed it outside. She didn't think it was a big deal. But if you are somebody who is scared of insects and bugs, that's something to keep in mind, that massive insects are not uncommon.
Important safety tip there. Couple questions. One is climbing the dunes. When you talk about climbing a large dune, how much time does that take?
Depending on how good a shape you're in, you can probably climb a dune in about an hour, hour and a half. So the okay. Big Daddy probably took us like an hour and a half. Climbing down, obviously, depending on whether or not you decide to actually climb down or slide down the way we did, could take you anywhere from 30 minutes to another hour.
And I'm seeing people climbing along the spine of the dune to get to the top, usually from the pictures I've seen.
Yes. The thing to keep in mind is that for every three steps you take, you'll probably slide back a step or two.
That's why I was
wondering. If you're going to climb from the sides, what tends to happen is that you will slide down far more often. Climbing on the spine tends to reduce the amount of slide that you have when you climb to the top.
Good to know. You're standing in the prettiest spot in Namibia that you saw. Let's narrow it to this trip. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
Without any doubt, the hot air balloon.
Sure.
Standing in the hot air balloon, looking at sunrise and the Skeleton Coast, and the fog is clearing, and you have the entirety of the Namib Desert laying flat and open in front of you. You're seeing a lone oryx that's walking by, creating these tracks. You're seeing the desert wildflower, and it's unbelievably desolate, beautiful, and something you will not see anywhere else.
Excellent. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Namibia.
We asked for red wine at the Sossusvlei Lodge.
Okay.
We assumed that the girl had understood what we had wanted. She brought back grape juice to us. She basically is like, yeah, we thought that wine is from grapes, right? This is, here we go. And we're like, sure, why not? This is great.
It's funny because you're not all that far from Cape Town, where you can find wonderful wines. In fact, many trips will start in Cape Town and then go up into Namibia. So, okay. Could be the one waitress, but...
No, so if I have to, say it all over again, only in Namibia would be that if you ask for spices, they will bring you salt and pepper, right? And only in Namibia is if you ask where the next gas station is, they will tell you, it's about 8 hours from here. So,
excellent. Our guest again has been Karthik Iyer. And Karthik, thank you so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Namibia.
Thank you very much, Chris. It's been a pleasure and a wonderful experience being part of the show.
In news of the community, it's still my plan to launch a Patreon campaign to support Amateur Traveler here over the next month or so. So stay tuned in the Facebook group, facebook.com/amateurtraveler, or on the mailing list for more information about that. I'll also put it in the show as well. But what kind of things you'll get, I have in mind that there'll be some episodes of Amateur Traveler that are probably topical that will not be available to the general population, and maybe you'll get Amateur Traveler sooner, maybe you'll get first chance at the Amateur Traveler trip. Those are the kind of things I have in mind, so let me know what you're thinking about that. I had three new reviews about the Amateur Traveler. Welcome to three new listeners. A Youper goes to Europe. I love this podcast. On my flight to Europe last summer, I listened to the podcast for the different countries we were going to. It was so fun. I also listened to them on the way home to see what I saw and compare. Great podcast. I'm hoping for an episode on the circle tour around Lake Superior. I'm planning to do this in the summer. We have something that covers part of that, but I don't think all of that. Can't wait to go to Provence. I'm planning to go to Provence for fall, and I have read dozens of blogs and listened to many podcasts. Wendy's insights were very refreshing with truly helpful tips, truly specific helpful tips. Her enthusiasm and pace was lovely. Thanks, Chris. Appreciate the guidance your podcasts offer. And then thirdly, really interesting and useful podcast. Have just started listening to this podcast, and I'm so impressed. Lots of really useful information and interesting insights. An indispensable resource for those who love travel. Well, thanks to all three of you for reviewing, and thanks for all of you who over the years have reviewed Amateur Traveler. It does help people find the show, and I always appreciate it. With that, we're going to end this episode of Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com and get on the mailing list. And as always, thanks so much for listening.